Anybody in the group here have any comments or questions?
Yes.
I have
a
laryngitis, so I'm thinking it might be hard to hear with the mic. You and I share two patients, both of them who have the BRCA1 gene. Both of them have teenage daughters. One of them has approached me. You don't know about this one yet. You know about the other. She wants to be sexually active, and she wants me to put her on a birth control pill. She doesn't know what her gene status is. And Steve Narod, for those who aren't medical, who's a major geneticist in the city, who's a specialist on the BRCA1 and 2 genes, he doesn't recommend that we put these girls on birth control pill until 25 years old, in case it may have some sort of, I guess, breast cancer causing effect. So therefore, we need to know her status. This is a 16-year-old, so she wants to know her genetic status and does not want her mother to know that she's being tested and wants to be tested. And of course, there's all kinds of insurance issues and life insurance and all that sort of thing. So what's it going to do with that sort of situation? And actually, I do have these two teenage girls going through this. One is that they decide not to be tested, but the other one wants to be tested.
Well, I think we're going to come to that a bit later about the age of telling women, but I would argue that the risk psychologically of testing some 16-year-old is infinitely greater than the risk of putting her on the pill. I think the literature about the pill is very, very scanty in terms of risk. And I think, you know, Stephen Narod, you know, he's got a different tune every week depending on, you know, where his p-value is after the most recent analysis. So we can talk about that. Let me just give you some follow-up, but we'll get more into the issue of, you know, when to disclose information to little kids. I just want to give you the follow-up on this case. I finally convinced Donna to stop nursing her 2-year-old so we could do some baseline breast screening and make sure everything was okay, and it was. And she went ahead and tried to have a baby, and she had 2 miscarriages and was very upset and said that her doctor told her she needs to go on some hormones in order to carry a successful pregnancy. Will that put her at too much risk? And I said, well, it may increase your risk of breast cancer a little bit, but I know you really want a baby, go for it. And it's a happy ending. She had a healthy second baby last October and is booked to have her ovaries out in the spring. And I'm just hoping that everything will be clear when she goes for ovarian surgery. So I think we should go to the next case.
Pardon? She can't hit the screen anymore. Yeah, keyboard anymore.
Oh. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, so this is coercion for testing and not sharing information.
Oh, this is in the back. Yeah, that's my case.
Okay.
Okay. Let me start it, yeah.
So this is Malka. She's a 20-year-old girl, and she's being considered for a shidduch, you know, ultra-Orthodox family. Her mother had breast cancer at age 35, but tried to keep this fact totally hidden from everybody in the community. Meanwhile, a friend tips off the boy's family about the mother's history of cancer. And the boy's family now insists that Malka has to get genetic testing before they'll consider this shidduch seriously. This is a real case. So there are a lot of questions. First of all, what would be the medical significance of a negative genetic test result for Malka? Now, presumably, we're going to be testing her properly. So we're going to start with her mother and test her mother. Now, if her mother carries a mutation and Malka doesn't, I mean, that's a wonderful scenario. That means Malka can, and the family can be reassured that her risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer is no higher than anybody else's, and this is a great shidduch, assuming she's a great girl. Right.
She's a great guy.
It's true, too. Absolutely. Now, if Malka tests positive, you know, obviously there's a problem here. Similarly, if the mother tests negative, then there's still maybe some hereditary risk in the family. Statistically, Malka's risk of breast cancer is 1.5 to 2 times higher than the general population. Is that enough reason to call off a shidduch? I certainly don't think so, but the boy's family might. So that's just simply the medical stuff. Would genetic testing have any direct benefits for Malka? Certainly. If she tests negative and her mother's positive, that's tremendous relief. If she tests positive, she can eventually take advantage of, you know, the screening and the prevention options. But, you know, certainly at this point in time, a positive test probably is not going to be beneficial. And if anything, it's going to be very psychologically damaging. Is this request for genetic testing ethical? We'll come to that. Assuming the Shadchan doesn't know much about genetics and doesn't know that Malka's mother should be tested first, would it be ethical to only test Malka? And then if she's negative, well, you know, maybe the mother's negative too, and we know that her negative test doesn't really clear her of an increased risk, but will that at least satisfy the Shadchan and make things a bit better? So, you know, we've got something not so ethical and something else not so ethical. I don't know if that's so good. Now, let's just to make this complicated, what if we knew that the boy carried a BRCA2 mutation? Now, if a BRCA2 mutation carrier and a BRCA1 mutation carrier marry, you can actually get double carriers. I think there's probably a higher risk of miscarriage, but some people do grow up normally carrying both mutations, and obviously they're at higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer. But, you know, here this couple is, you know, definitely putting their kids at extremely high risk. Should this be one of those forbidden shidduchs from an ethical point of view, or do you like the Tay-Sachs carriers, or should it be okay? And finally, just generally, how much is one morally obligated to disclose to a shadchan about one's family history? I mean, if we all go back, we all have something horrible, you know, hiding in the closet.
I wonder if you do the second case as well about shidduchs and okay.
So why don't you do that?
The other thing is, if he has BRCA2 and she has BRCA2 and they get married, their child has a risk of having Fanconi's anemia, which is a very serious disease. So even more so, maybe to discuss it. So this is just another example of, it was sort of related, it was about a shidduch, and I'll just move it to the family history because it's a little easier. This is Jason, and Jason was married to a woman who developed colon cancer at 32, and his wife actually passed away at 32 years old, leaving him with three little kids. Jason's wife had a whole family history of cancer that she wasn't told about. So her mother had had colon cancer a few times and endometrial cancer, but it was never discussed with her. And so Jason actually really resents his machatanim because they never talked about the cancer in the family. And he feels that if she would have known, she could have gone for screening early because the mom was diagnosed young too, and maybe she wouldn't have died of this. In the meantime, though, he asked his mother-in-law to go and have genetic testing. And his mother-in-law was found to have HMPCC. And Julie, who's 18, is now being set up for a shidduch. And Jason doesn't want to tell Julie about the genetic testing and the fact that it was done because he doesn't want Julie's to know about it or to affect the shidduch at all. And so Julie was never informed that genetic testing was done in the family. What makes this a little bit worse is that Jason's niece, Eileen, is having colonoscopy. She's well aware of the genetic testing done in the family, and she was found to have a polyp that might have become cancerous, and she's only 20. So this is even more concerning because Julie is at an age where she really should start doing her colonoscopy screening. So we're going to talk about the shidduch, I guess, for both. But with regards to this one, it's the medical issues. Is it fair for a parent to withhold this information from their child? And since the cousin had a polyp at 20, what are the medical concerns for the rest of Jason's children? Because they're all starting to become of age where they really should be getting their colonoscopy screening. So maybe we can talk about... I'll move back to your questions. There's so many more of them.
The first thing is it speaks to our crazy world out there, the whole shidduch world. And I mean that really, I don't mean that as a joke. I think in many ways it's a sad case. The simple answer, you tell a shadchan nothing. And I'll explain what I mean by that. One has to reveal information to a spouse, a prospective spouse, as I said. But you do not have to reveal it before you know the person. Because no one is going to go out with somebody if they know there's extra high risk. And everybody has a right to have a potential to meet a marriage partner. The question is, at what point do you tell? I'll come back to that. The other point being, you know, where do we draw the line? I mean, the person has a risk for this. You can test for everything. It's like it gets totally out of whack. And it's not ethical, really, of the boy to ask. I mean, the boy doesn't have to marry or doesn't have to go out with anybody. But to insist that somebody get a genetic test before he'll go out is a sick society, I think, where we're going to that extreme. And what the question is, when do you have to tell, is not an easy question, but you do not have to tell on a first date, on a second date. In the ultra-Orthodox world, to use the term you used, you know, when they only go out for 6, 7, 8 dates, you know, after 2, 3 dates, it's already, this is a serious issue. In other words, you have to tell before it's too late, I would think. I would think you have to tell before the wedding. Again, I don't think you have to tell necessarily. I would not think you'd have to tell BRCA if you're a carrier of the gene. That's not a sickness. That's not a disease. To carry a gene is not a disease. If you're sick, if a person has a heart condition, they're literally, you know, and doctors say their life expectancy may be lower. That you have to tell. But I don't think you have to tell these things even maybe till after you're married. I don't think that's an obligation. But even a heart condition, you don't have to tell a shofet anything. But you would have to tell the prospective spouse at some point as the relationship is developing. In terms of the parent-child here, what else do we have here to answer here? How much you disclosed, you discussed? And it's probably not a good idea to test somebody at the age of 20, as you said, the mental anguish. A parent, in general, at what age do you tell a child when the information is necessary? That doesn't really answer a specific question, but it depends on what it is. So on Pesachs, for example, the old examples, so you had to do it before a person is married. You'd have to do, you know, pre-screening. I believe Rabbi Bleich recommended you do it really at adolescence, even before it becomes a real issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein, I said, wait till 20. He said 18 for a girl, 20 for a boy. That gave you the indication when people are getting married, I guess. But you really have to tell when it's useful. So it would depend on each case. And just one more point I'll add, I really want to give other people. On colon, it's much less of an issue because, as Dr. Gallinger said, it's really 100% cure. It's 100% preventable. So you don't have to say anything. You just have to make the person aware to have testing on a regular basis. There's no disease. There isn't anything at all. So carrying a gene is not a disease. I think we have to move beyond that. So
I think that point probably is the most relevant. Is that these are all statistics we give people. You know, even something as high as 80%, 20% are not going to get the condition. And there are what are called modifier genes. There's other genes. There's 30,000 genes, and some of those genes modify the BRCA1 and 2 gene, and we don't actually know much about them and diet and other factors. So there's a lot of mystery that we don't know. So to have that kind of information governing your life or a marriage or whatever, it does seem kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, and the last point is that statistically, Malka's not at really high risk for another 20 years. The rate of progress in medicine in terms of, you know, non-surgical prevention strategies and screening is fabulous. I mean, we will probably very soon have a blood test that will tell you with, you know, very good accuracy that a person has a very tiny tumor and we'll be able to treat it and cure it. I mean, you know, maybe 10 years, but, you know, we're going to get there. Even gene replacement therapy will probably happen eventually.
That was really the whole idea that our rabbis were saying. And when you build up more trust, you can talk more. So on a first date, it's too early. Question is, at what point do you talk about it? So that's not easy always to know. But I do agree that is an important point, building up trust. Next, please.
So the next. Right, so the next case is about the prenatal testing, the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So this is a story about Josh. These are actually real cases, but Josh is 36 years old. He lost his mom to breast cancer when he was very young, and it was very traumatic for him. Josh was tested, and he actually has a BRCA2 mutation, so that was confirmed. He got married, and now they're thinking about having children. And what this couple decided to do, Josh is a very well-educated person, they decided to that they would like to have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So what that is the couple has to go through IVF first. They have to have in vitro fertilization. And they take the egg from the woman and sperm from the man and mix it in a dish together, and hopefully you get a fertilized egg. And that egg starts as one cell, and that one cell will divide into two, and that two cells will divide into four, and so on and so on and so on until a baby is formed. If the egg that you extracted from the woman has a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, the fertilized egg is going to have a BRCA2 mutation. When it copies itself to make two cells, both cells will have a BRCA2 mutation inside of it, and so on and so on and so on. So when the cell is maybe eight cells, when the embryo is maybe eight cells big, you can take one little cell off that embryo and test it to see, does that one particular cell have a BRCA2 mutation? And it's a photocopy of the rest of the cells in the embryo. So if it has a mutation, then that embryo is affected. If it doesn't have a mutation, then that embryo is not affected. And the idea is to implant back the embryos that are not affected. You can use this theory to determine whether the baby is a boy or not, too, because the sex of the baby is determined as early as when the egg and sperm meet. So a boy has a genetic code of XY, and when the egg and sperm meet, the fertilized egg will be XY for a boy or XX for a girl. As it starts photocopying itself, every cell in the body has an XY. Every cell in my body hopefully has an XX, because I'm a girl. After I tested it, it does. So so you can extract one cell from a little embryo with eight cells, and you can see that it's got an XY code, and that embryo is going to be a boy. And we were talking a little bit about, in the BRCA families at least, would you have a family or a situation where they would only want to implant boys' embryos because boys don't have a risk for ovarian cancer. And although they have a risk for breast cancer, it's not as high as a woman's risk for breast cancer. So the whole idea of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis came up for this case. And what makes it a little bit harder is that there are other people in the family, like his niece Rebecca, who have a BRCA2 mutation. So she's born, she's here, she's got a BRCA mutation. And some of the issues that came up in this case is, first of all, can you do this kind of magic testing, the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis? And we've discovered through this case that you can do this. There are three labs in the States that are willing to test for BRCA mutations. If the couple goes through IVF here, and there are clinics here that will help a couple go through in vitro fertilization to extract the embryos and send it off to the States. The States will test it and tell them which embryos are unaffected. And so yes, the first answer is yes, it's available. The second question involves, do they understand the implications of doing this? So do they understand they have to actually go through IVF, which carries its own risk? The success rate for pregnancy isn't the same as a natural way to get pregnant. And the other thing is that they would have to promise to do prenatal testing. So once the embryos are implanted back in the woman, they would have to consent to either having an amniocentesis, which is when they stick a needle into the belly of the pregnant woman and take out some of the amniotic fluid, and some of the skin cells of the baby will shed off in that fluid, so you can actually look at the skin cell, which again is just a photocopy of the original cell, and see if the baby has a mutation or not. So amniocentesis, or they can have another test called a CBS. Again, it's going in and taking some sample from the baby when it's in utero. Both of these have a risk of miscarriage. By doing these prenatal testing, you can have a miscarriage. A small risk, but it's there. The other thing is, does Josh really understand what having a BRCA mutation is? I mean, he lost his mom young. In this family, a lot of the family was lost in the Holocaust, and that we do see in a lot of our Jewish families. So he doesn't have any living relatives that he can look at to say there are survivors of breast cancer. And when his daughter is eventually born, I mean, we have no idea what kind of gene therapy or screening might be available to a 20-year-old, you know, 20, 30 years from now. The other thing is, how is this going to impact the rest of the family? His niece, Rebecca, who has a BRCA2 mutation, is it going to make her feel devalued, like she shouldn't really have been born or shouldn't be here because, you know, he would probably terminate those embryos if they have this mutation. So this was one of the cases that came up.
My first again? Oh boy, okay, I'm sorry. So I alluded to this earlier. I think this also is carrying the experiment and the intervention a little too far. You know, to do this to prevent a serious illness like Tay-Sachs or something, where, let's say now you find there are two people who are carriers who are married to each other, they're, you know, whatever they and they already had a Tay-Sachs child, God forbid, and now they want to do it, that would probably be allowed, obviously, because there's a real benefit. But as we've been explaining, it's a 50% chance, a 60% chance in 50 years. Who knows, between now and 50 years is like a life, it's more than a lifetime in medicine. So clearly, this technology, because it involves wasting of the seed, it involves all these types of procedures, I don't think we could allow it for this type. Again, the question is, where do you draw that line? What might you allow it for? But I don't think in this case we could allow it, and I think it's relatively clear. Again, it's not, in Judaism, before we allow, you know, prohibitions, there has to be a clear risk, a clear benefit, depending on what angle we're looking from. And this is too far in the future, so we don't really know what's going to be. And again, the education, explaining to people, you know, I think is a much better approach. But the use of the, you know, the of this method of you know, the potential, I think, is wonderful as we discover, you know, other types of things in theory. But I don't think that here, not anybody.
We agree in the medical community.
Right.
I mean, we don't recommend prenatal screening for these. And we wouldn't, I mean, we would really have a long talk with this family,
right,
to make sure they really understand. And it's not something that we do in Canada, PGD, and we don't do prenatal testing for any of the diseases here in Canada either. So, and we get asked a lot from couples to say, can we test, you know, unborn fetuses and so forth, and we explain why we don't do that, because, you know, these people, the children have a right to make their own decision when they're 16, 18 years old, so the parents, we feel, don't really have that right to test them, because this is an adult onset susceptibility disease. So the parents don't have a right to make decisions about their embryo and their embryo's life and their genetic status. That baby has a right to make their own decision when they're older, and that right might be that they don't want to know. So we talk a lot about that.
What's probably going on here is that Jason has just an unresolved grief reaction to his mother's death, and there are a number of psychotherapists in the city who specialize in dealing with these families and helping them work through a lot of these issues, and it's often very helpful and helps people make much better choices, and, you know, it helps them in other aspects of their life as well.
We really only have a few minutes left, so maybe we'll just take some questions from the audience at this time. Does anybody else on the panel have any specific comments? Anybody have any questions on anything with respect to this case or any of
the topics in general?
I had a question about the case with Jennifer Willis, who used the information. I'm just wondering if it would be considered unethical or maybe even against your guidelines or altogether
This is actually, the story goes on and on for Jennifer. It's a real life case, and
I mean, the way that I've handled it is I've counseled her, like, she has HMPCC, and I don't make too many wishy-washy comments about it. So if she reads me well enough, she'll know that she's got HMPCC. But she was actually just dropped my office the other day, and I showed her we have an envelope sitting there, a sealed envelope with her results. She knows that it's there. She doesn't want to hear what the results are. So, but she's allowed her children to get tested based on these results, and she doesn't want to hear the words because she already feels so guilty about the fact that she had a child affected with cancer, and she can't bear the thought that we would tell her that we've confirmed the genetic disease. So she doesn't want to know, even though she asks a lot of questions and she wants her family to have this information available, but she can't hear the words. So I've shown her that sealed envelope, but she's not going for it. Not yet. Yeah.
Anybody else?
I mean, I'm sort of guessing maybe she had some prenatal testing that told her everything was clear and there was no disease. Maybe the baby was then born with a disease. I don't know.
Yeah. I believe this was a religious Christian doctor who did not advise the patient who was over 35 to go for amniocentesis. So she did not go for amniocentesis, not knowing that amniocentesis, she was in a small town, but she was not aware of the test. So you can imagine, you can finish the story now yourself. The baby was born with Down, so it was now a wrongful birth suit because she said she would definitely have aborted had she known, but she didn't know because she didn't have the test, and she didn't have the test because the doctor was a religious Christian. And
those are two different. In the first scenario, if someone had prenatal testing and it was wrong, I would say that people have to be very aware that lab errors happen. Lab errors happen, and they happen to us, and we see them. And so getting a result back, you have to be aware that lab errors happen. And even if people have prenatal testing, they're always told that there's a background risk that a baby could be born with a birth defect. In that case where the doctor didn't inform, that I would sue too. Because any woman over 35 has the right to have an amniocentesis because they're at higher risk to have not only baby with Down syndrome, but any of the chromosomal abnormalities are increased. And so it's a right that they should have been told about. The fact that they weren't told was, and especially if it's based on the doctor's religious reasons, is grounds for suing, I think.
In this case, there was a test that was misread. And I guess the whole concept of the wrongful life, especially from the rabbi, I'd like to know what your view is on this.
Yeah, again, okay, on the errors, in general, just in terms of suing a physician, Jewish law says it's very hard to sue a physician. A licensed, trained physician who makes a mistake, again, I'm not, as a general rule, cannot be sued in Jewish law. And what goes on today in the Western world, Judaism says anybody who's licensed and practiced, they're not God. We make mistakes. That's what it means to be human. And if the person did normal stuff, and they really made a mistake, you can't sue such a person. So their lab errors, that's part of the system. The second question, Esther's question, is much more complex. I remember when I was at YU and some of my friends went on interviews for medical school, so they would ask them in the interview, you're a religious Jew, will you do an abortion? What are you supposed to do when your religious beliefs, which is clearly the belief of the doctor, go against the statutes, the laws of the land? That's a much more complex issue, obviously, but I would agree the basic approach is you live in Canada, you live in the United States, you cannot impose your religious, the beliefs on somebody. By offering amniocentesis doesn't mean you have to do it. You're letting the person, choose it. So I would think that it's related to the other thing you raised. The person who wanted the pill wanted, testing at 17 because they were sexually active. Again, from a Jewish point of view, clearly that's not acceptable. But how that plays into a medical advice, I think, is not really relevant. I don't think it's even an Orthodox, you know, a physician. I don't think that's his role to be the moral arbiter for other people. Perhaps in a Jewish state that is run according to medical ethics Jewishly, it might be a different type of a situation. But I think living in Canada, whatever your religious beliefs are, that can't interfere on the options you give the patients, while at the same time respecting the right of the physician, not for them themselves to have to be engaged in such activity. So those are, I hope they answer both aspects a little bit.
Anybody else? Who'd like the last question?
Warren, you take it.
Okay, well, actually mine's a, it's not really a Jewish medical ethics question, but it's a technical question. What about the, this is for Dr. Gallinger, what about the virtual colonoscopies done by MRI? Is this something that's going to take over colonoscopy before I turn 50?
Uh-oh. How many weeks do you have?
It's actually it's a CT scan. So at the moment, it's a test whereby you lie on a table, have a CT scan, and air is put up the bottom instead of a scope, and the computer can reconstruct the view so that in the end it actually looks like a colonoscopy to the radiologist. So at the moment, a prep is still necessary. So for those who think that they can avoid the prep, that's not the case. Although in the future, we think there will be a prepless virtual colonoscopy.
Virtual prep.
It's also, it's been shown to be effective in detecting polyps over about a centimeter, but the smaller ones are not. And at the moment, it's considered investigational in Canada, and in Toronto actually. So it's done at Mount Sinai, but you have to have a colonoscopy afterwards because we're using it as an investigational tool to see if it compares or how it compares with colonoscopy. Most people think that in 5 years, if the technology proceeds as expected, it will replace screening colonoscopy because most colonoscopies are negative. Of course, if you have a polyp, you then have to have a regular colonoscopy to have it removed. But it's a fantastic technology, but it's not available broadly yet here. So you have to wait a little while longer, but I think it's coming.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to thank everybody. Thanks, everybody.